Penguin Random House Audio presents Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir in books. This is the author, Azar Nafisi. In memory of my mother, Nishat Nafisi, for my father, Ahmad Nafisi, and my family, Bijan, Negar, and Dara Naderi. To whom do we tell what happened on the earth? For whom do we place everywhere huge mirrors in the hope that they will be filled up and will stay so? Czeslaw Milosz, Annalena. Author's note. Aspects of characters and events in this story have been changed mainly to protect individuals, not just from the eye of the censor, but also from those who read such narratives to discover who is who and who did what to whom, thriving on and filling their own emptiness through others' secrets. The facts in this story are true insofar as any memory is ever truthful. But I have made every effort to protect friends and students, baptizing them with new names and disguising them perhaps even from themselves, changing and interchanging facets of their lives so that their secrets are safe. Part 1. Lolita. 1. In the fall of 1995, after resigning from my last academic post, I decided to indulge myself and fulfill a dream. I chose 7 of my best and most committed students and invited them to come to my home every Thursday morning to discuss literature. They were all women. To teach a mixed class in the privacy of my home was too risky, even if we were discussing harmless works of fiction. One persistent male student, although barred from our class, insisted on his rights. So he, Nima, read the assigned material, and on special days he would come to my house to talk about the books we were reading. I often teasingly reminded my students of Muriel Sparks, the prime of Miss Jean Brodie, and asked, "Which one of you will finally betray me?" For I am a pessimist by nature, and I was sure at least one would turn against me. Nasreen once responded mischievously, "You yourself told us that in the final analysis, we are our own betrayers, playing Judas to our own Christ." Mana pointed out that I was no Miss Brodie, and they, well, they were what they were. She reminded me of a warning I was fond of repeating, "Do not, under any circumstances, belittle a work of fiction by trying to turn it into a carbon copy of real life. What we search for in fiction is not so much reality, but the epiphany of truth." Yet I suppose that if I were to go against my own recommendation and choose a work of fiction that would most resonate with our lives in the Islamic Republic of Iran, it would not be the prime of Miss Jean Brodie, or even 1984, but perhaps Nabokov's Invitation to a Beheading, or better yet, Lolita. A couple of years after we had begun our Thursday morning seminars, on the last night I was in Tehran, a few friends and students came to say goodbye and to help me pack. When we had deprived the house of all its items, when the objects had vanished and the colors had faded into 8 gray suitcases like errant genies evaporating into their bottles, my students and I stood against the bare white wall of the dining room and took 2 photographs. I have the 2 photographs in front of me now. In the first, there are 7 women standing against the white wall. They are, according to the law of the land, dressed in black robes and headscarves, covered except for the oval of their faces and their hands. In the second photograph, the same group in the same position stands against the same wall. Only they have taken off their coverings. Splashes of color separate one from the next, Each has become distinct through the color and style of her clothes, the color and the length of her hair. Not even the two who are still wearing their headscarves look the same. The one to the far right in the second photograph is our poet, Mana, in a white t-shirt and jeans. She made poetry out of things most people cast aside. The photograph does not reflect the peculiar opacity of Mana's dark eyes, a testament to her withdrawn and private nature. Next to Mana is Mahshid, whose long black scarf clashes with her delicate features and retreating smile. Mahshid was good at many things, but she had a certain daintiness about her, and we took to calling her my lady. Nasreen used to say that more than defining Mahshid, we had managed to add another dimension to the word lady. Mahshid is very sensitive. She's like porcelain, Yasin once told me, easy to crack. That's why she appears fragile to those who don't know her too well. But woe to whoever offends her. As for me, Yasi continued good-naturedly, I'm like good old plastic. I won't crack, no matter what you do with me. Yasi was the youngest in our group. She's the one in yellow, bending forward and bursting with laughter. We used to teasingly call her our comedian. Yasi was shy by nature, but certain things excited her and made her lose her inhibitions. She had a tone of voice that gently mocked and questioned not just others, but herself as well. I'm the one in brown, standing next to Yasi with one arm around her shoulders. Directly behind me stands Azin, my tallest student with her long blonde hair and a pink t-shirt. She's laughing like the rest of us. Azin's smiles never looked like smiles. They appeared more like preludes to an irrepressible and nervous hilarity. She beamed in that peculiar fashion, even when she was describing her latest trouble with her husband. Always outrageous and outspoken, Azin relished the shock value of her actions and comments, and often clashed with Mahshid and Mana. We nicknamed her the Wild One. On my other side is Mitra, who was perhaps the calmest among us. Like the pastel colors of her paintings, she seemed to recede and fade into a paler register. Her beauty was saved from predictability by a pair of miraculous dimples, which she could and did use to manipulate many an unsuspecting victim into bending to her will. Sanaz, who, pressured by family and society, vacillated between her desire for independence and her need for approval, is holding on to Mitra's arm. We are all laughing. And Nima, Mana's husband and my one truly literary critic, if only he had had the perseverance to finish the brilliant essays he started to write, is our invisible partner, the photographer. There was one more. Nasreen. She's not in the photographs. She didn't make it to the end. Yet my tale would be incomplete without those who could not or did not remain with us. Their absences persist like an acute pain that seems to have no physical source. This is Tehran for me. Its absences were more real than its presences. When I see Nasreen in my mind's eye, she's slightly out of focus, blurred, somehow distant. I've combed through the photographs my students took with me over the years, and Nasreen is in many of them, but always hidden behind something, a person, a tree. In one, I'm standing with eight of my students in the small garden facing our faculty building, the scene of so many farewell photographs over the years. In the background stands a sheltering willow tree. We are laughing, and in one corner, from behind the tallest student, Nasreen peers out, like an imp intruding roguishly on a scene it was not invited to. In another, I can barely make out her face in the small V space behind two other girls' shoulders. In this one, she looks absent-minded. She's frowning as if unaware that she's being photographed. How can I describe Nasreen? I once called her the Cheshire Cat, appearing and disappearing at unexpected turns in my academic life. The truth is, I can't describe her. She was her own definition. One can only say that Nasreen was Nasreen. For nearly 2 years, almost every Thursday morning, rain or shine, they came to my house, and almost every time, I couldn't get over the shock of seeing them shed their mandatory veils and robes and burst into color. When my students came into that room, they took off more than their scarves and robes. Gradually, each one gained an outline and a shape, becoming her own inimitable self. Our world in that living room, with its window framing my beloved Alborz Mountains, became our sanctuary, our self-contained universe mocking the reality of black-scarved, timid faces in the city that sprawled below. The theme of the class was the relation between fiction and reality. We read Persian classical literature, such as the tales of our own lady of fiction, Shahrazad, from 1001 Nights, along with Western classics, Pride and Prejudice, Madame Bovary, Daisy Miller, The Dean's December, and yes, Lolita. As I write the title of each book, memories whirl in with the wind to disturb the quiet of this fall day in another room in another country. Here and now, in that other world that cropped up so many times in our discussions, I sit and reimagine myself and my students, my girls, as I came to call them, reading Lolita in a deceptively sunny room in Tehran. But to steal the words from Humbert, the poet criminal of Lolita, I need you, the reader, to imagine us, for we won't really exist if you don't. Against the tyranny of time and politics, imagine us the way we sometimes didn't dare to imagine ourselves, in our most private and secret moments, in the most extraordinarily ordinary instances of life, listening to music, falling in love, walking down the shady streets, or reading Lolita in Tehran. And then imagine us again with all this confiscated, driven underground taken away from us. If I write about Nabokov today, it is to celebrate our reading of Nabokov in Tehran, against all odds. Of all his novels, I choose the one I taught last, and the one that is connected to so many memories. It is of Lolita that I want to write. But right now, there is no way I can write about that novel without also writing about Tehran. This, then, is the story of Lolita in Tehran, how Lolita gave a different color to Tehran, and how Tehran helped redefine Nabokov's novel, turning it into this Lolita, our Lolita. 2. And so it happened that one Thursday in early September, we gathered in my living room for our first meeting. Here they come one more time. First I hear the bell, a pause, and the closing of the street door. Then I hear footsteps coming up the winding staircase and past my mother's apartment. As I move towards the front door, I register a piece of sky through the side window. Each girl, as soon as she reaches the door, takes off her robe and scarf, sometimes shaking her head from side to side. She pauses before entering the room. Only there is no room, just the teasing void of memory. More than any other place in our home, the living room was symbolic of my nomadic and borrowed life. Vagrant pieces of furniture from different times and places were thrown together, partly out of financial necessity and partly because of my eclectic taste. Oddly, these incongruous ingredients created a symmetry that the other, more deliberately furnished rooms in the apartment lacked. My mother would go crazy each time she saw the paintings leaning against the wall and the vases of flowers on the floor and the curtainless windows which I refused to dress until I was finally reminded that this was an Islamic country and windows needed to be dressed. "I don't know if you really belong to me," she would lament. "Didn't I raise you to be orderly and organized?" Her tone was serious, but she had repeated the same complaint for so many years that by now it was an almost tender ritual. "Azi," that was my nickname. "Azi," she would say, "you are a grown-up lady now. Act like one." Yet there was something in her tone that kept me young and fragile and obstinate. And still, when in memory I hear her voice, I know I never lived up to her expectations. I never did become the lady she tried to will me into being. That room, which I never paid much attention to at that time, has gained a different status in my mind's eye now that it has become the precious object of memory. It was a spacious room, sparsely furnished and decorated. At one corner was the fireplace, a fanciful creation of my husband Bijan. There was a love seat against one wall over which I had thrown a lace cover, my mother's gift from long ago. A pale peach couch faced the window, accompanied by two matching chairs and a big square glass-topped iron table. My place was always in the chair, with its back to the window, which opened onto a wide cul-de-sac called Azar. Opposite the window was the former American hospital, once small and exclusive, now a noisy, overcrowded medical facility for wounded and disabled veterans of the war. On weekends, Thursdays and Fridays in Iran, the small street was crowded with hospital visitors who came as if for a picnic, with sandwiches and children. The neighbor's front yard, his pride and joy, was the main victim of their assaults, especially in summer when they helped themselves to his beloved roses. We could hear the sound of children shouting, crying, and laughing, and mingled in their mothers' voices also shouting, calling out their children's names and threatening them with punishments. Sometimes a child or two would ring our doorbell and run away, repeating their perilous exercise at intervals. From our second-story apartment, my mother occupied the first floor, and my brother's apartment on the third floor was often empty since he had left for England. We could see the upper branches of a generous tree and in the distance over the buildings the Alborz Mountains. The street, the hospital, and its visitors were censored out of sight. We felt their presence only through the disembodied noises emanating from below. I could not see my favorite mountains from where I sat, but opposite my chair, on the far wall of the dining room, was an antique oval mirror, a gift from my father, and in its reflection I could see the mountains capped with snow, even in summer, and watch the trees change color. That censored view intensified my impression that the noise came not from the street below, but from some far-off place, a place whose persistent hum was our only link to the world we refused for those few hours to acknowledge. That room, for all of us, became a place of transgression. What a wonderland it was! Sitting around the large coffee table covered with bouquets of flowers, we moved in and out of the novels we read. Looking back, I'm amazed at how much we learned without even noticing it. We were to borrow from Nabokov to experience how the ordinary pebble of ordinary life could be transformed into a jewel through the magic eye of fiction. 3. 6 a.m., the first day of class. I was already up. Too excited to eat breakfast, I put the coffee on and then took a long, leisurely shower. The water caressed my neck, my back, my legs, and I stood there both rooted and light. For the first time in many years, I felt a sense of anticipation that was not marred by tension. I would not need to go through the torturous rituals that had marked my days when I taught at the university, rituals governing what I was forced to wear, how I was expected to act, the gestures I had to remember to control. For this class, I would prepare differently. Life in the Islamic Republic was as capricious as the month of April, when short periods of sunshine would suddenly give way to showers and storms. It was unpredictable. The regime would go through cycles of some tolerance, followed by a crackdown. Now, after a period of relative calm and so-called liberalization, we had again entered a time of hardships. Universities had once more become the targets of attack by the cultural purists who were busy imposing stricter sets of laws, going so far as to segregate men and women in classes and punishing disobedient professors. The University of Allameh Tabatabai, where I had been teaching since 1987, had been singled out as the most liberal university in Iran. It was rumored that someone in the Ministry of Higher Education had asked, rhetorically, if the faculty at Allameh thought they lived in Switzerland. Switzerland had somehow become a byword for Western laxity. Any program or action that was deemed un-Islamic was reproached with a mocking reminder that Iran was by no means Switzerland. The pressure was hardest on the students. I felt helpless as I listened to their endless tales of woe. Female students were being penalized for running up the stairs when they were late for classes, for laughing in the hallways, for talking to members of the opposite sex. One day, Sanaz had barged into the class near the end of the session, crying. In between bursts of tears, she explained that she was late because the female guards at the door, finding a blush in her bag, had tried to send her home with a reprimand. Why did I stop teaching so suddenly? I had asked myself this question many times. Was it the declining quality of the university? The ever-increasing indifference among the remaining faculty and students? The daily struggle against arbitrary rules and restrictions? I smiled as I rubbed the coarse loofah over my skin, remembering the reaction of the university officials to my letter of resignation. They had harassed and limited me in all manner of ways, monitoring my visitors, controlling my actions, refusing a long overdue tenure, and when I resigned, they infuriated me by suddenly commiserating and by refusing to accept my resignation. The students had threatened to boycott classes, and it was of some satisfaction to me to find out later that despite threats of reprisals, they in fact did boycott my replacement. Everyone thought I would break down and eventually return. It took 2 more years before they finally accepted my resignation. I remember a friend told me, "You don't understand their mentality. They won't accept your resignation because they don't think you have the right to quit. They are the ones who decide how long you should stay and when you should be dispensed with." More than anything else, it was this arbitrariness that had become unbearable. "What will you do?" my friends had asked. "Will you just stay home now?" "Well, I could write another book," I would tell them. But in truth, I had no definite plans. I was still dealing with the aftershocks of a book on Nabokov I had just published, and only vague ideas like vapors formed when I turned to consider the shape of my next book. I could, for a while at least, continue the pleasant task of studying Persian classics. But one particular project, a notion I had been nurturing for years, was uppermost in my mind. For a long time, I had dreamt of creating a special class, one that would give me the freedoms denied me in the classes I taught in the Islamic Republic. I wanted to teach a handful of selected students wholly committed to the study of literature. students who were not handpicked by the government, who had not chosen English literature simply because they had not been accepted in other fields or because they thought an English degree would be a good career move. Teaching in the Islamic Republic, like any other vocation, was subservient to politics and subject to arbitrary rules. Always, the joy of teaching was marred by diversions and considerations forced on us by the regime. How well could one teach when the main concern of university officials was not the quality of one's work, but the color of one's lips, the subversive potential of a single strand of hair? Could one really concentrate on one's job when what preoccupied the faculty was how to excise the word wine from a Hemingway story, when they decided not to teach Bronte because she appeared to condone adultery? I was reminded of a painter friend who had started her career by depicting scenes from life, mainly deserted rooms, abandoned houses, and discarded photographs of women. Gradually, her work became more abstract, and in her last exhibition, her paintings were splashes of rebellious color, like the two in my living room, dark patches with little droplets of blue. I asked about her progress from modern realism to abstraction. "Reality has become so intolerable," she said, "so bleak, that all I can paint now are the colors of my dreams." "The colors of my dreams," I repeated to myself, stepping out of the shower and onto the cool tiles. I like that. How many people get a chance to paint the colors of their dreams? I put on my oversized bathrobe. It felt good to move from the security of the embracing water to the protective cover of a bathrobe wrapped around my body. I walked barefoot into the kitchen, put some coffee into my favorite mug, the one with red strawberries, and sat down forgetfully on the divan in the hall. This class was the color of my dreams. It entailed an active withdrawal from a reality that had turned hostile. I wanted very badly to hold on to my rare mood of jubilance and optimism. For in the back of my mind, I didn't know what awaited me at the end of this project. "You're aware," a friend had said, "that you are more and more withdrawing into yourself, and now that you have cut your relations with the university, your whole contact with the outside world will be mainly restricted to one room." "Where will you go from here?" he had asked. "Withdrawal into one's dreams could be dangerous," I reflected, padding into the bedroom to change. This I had learned from Nabokov's crazy dreamers like Kinbot and Humbert. In selecting my students, I did not take into consideration their ideological or religious backgrounds. Later, I would count it as the class's great achievement that such a mixed group, with different and at times conflicting backgrounds, personal as well as religious and social, remained so loyal to its goals and ideals. One reason for my choice of these particular girls was the peculiar mixture of fragility and courage I sensed in them. They were what you would call loners who did not belong to any particular group or sect. I admired their ability to survive, not despite, but in some ways because of their solitary lives. "We can call the class a space of our own," Mana had suggested, a sort of communal version of Virginia Woolf's Room of Her Own. I spent longer than usual choosing my clothes that first morning, trying on different outfits until I finally settled on a red striped shirt and black corduroy jeans. I applied my makeup with care and put on a bright red lipstick. As I fastened my small gold earrings, I suddenly panicked. What if it doesn't work? What if they won't come? Don't do that. Suspend all fears for the next 5 or 6 hours at least. Please, I pleaded with myself, putting on my shoes and going into the kitchen. 4. I was making tea when the doorbell rang. I was so preoccupied with my thoughts that I didn't hear it the first time. I opened the door to Mahshid. "I thought you weren't home," she said, handing me a bouquet of white and yellow daffodils. As she was taking off her black robe, I told her, "There are no men in the house. You can take that off too." She hesitated before uncoiling her long black scarf. Mahshid and Yossi both observed the veil, but Yossi of late had become more relaxed in the way she wore her scarf. She tied it with a loose knot under her throat, her dark brown hair untidily parted in the middle, peeping out from underneath. Mahshid's hair, however, was meticulously styled and curled under. Her short bangs gave her a strangely old-fashioned look that struck me as more European than Iranian. She wore a deep blue jacket over her white shirt with a huge yellow butterfly embroidered on its right side. I pointed to the butterfly. "Did you wear this in honor of Nabokov?" I no longer remember when Mahshid first began to take my classes at the university. Somehow it seems as if she had always been there. Her father, a devout Muslim, had been an ardent supporter of the revolution. She wore the scarf even before the revolution, and in her class diary, she wrote about the lonely mornings when she went to a fashionable girls' college where she felt neglected and ignored, ironically because of her then conspicuous attire. After the revolution, she was jailed for 5 years because of her affiliation with a dissident religious organization and banned from continuing her education for 2 years after she was out of jail. I imagine her, in those pre-revolutionary days, walking along the uphill street leading to the college on countless sunny mornings. I see her walking alone, her head to the ground. Then as now, she did not enjoy the day's brilliance. I say then as now, because the revolution that imposed the scarf on others did not relieve Mahshid of her loneliness. Before the revolution, she could in a sense take pride in her isolation. At that time, she had worn the scarf as a testament to her faith. Her decision was a voluntary act. When the revolution forced the scarf on others, her action became meaningless. Mahshid is proper in the true sense of the word. She has grace and a certain dignity. Her skin is the color of moonlight, and she has almond-shaped eyes and jet-black hair. She wears pastel colors and is soft-spoken. Her pious background should have shielded her, but it didn't. I cannot imagine her in jail. Over the many years I have known Mahshid, she has rarely alluded to her jail experiences, which left her with a permanently impaired kidney. One day in class, as we were talking about our daily terrors and nightmares, she mentioned that her jail memories visited her from time to time and that she had still not found a way to articulate them. But, she added, everyday life does not have fewer horrors than prison. I asked Mahshid if she wanted some tea. Always considerate, she said she'd rather wait for the others and apologized for being a little early. "Can I help?" she asked. "There's really nothing to help with. Make yourself at home," I told her as I stepped into the kitchen with the flowers and searched for a vase. The bell rang again. "I'll get it," Mahshid cried out from the living room. I heard laughter. Mana and Yossi had arrived. Mana came into the kitchen holding a small bouquet of roses. "It's from Nima," she said. "He wants to make you feel bad about excluding him from the class. He says he'll carry a bouquet of roses and march in front of your house during class hours in protest." She was beaming. A few brief sparkles flashed in her eyes and died down again. Putting the pastries onto a large tray, I asked Mana if she envisioned the words to her poems in colors. Nabokov writes in his autobiography that he and his mother saw the letters of the alphabet in color, I explained. He says of himself that he's a painterly writer. The Islamic Republic coarsened my taste in colors, Mana said, fingering the discarded leaves of her roses. I want to wear outrageous colors, like shocking pink or tomato red. I feel too greedy for colors to see them in carefully chosen words of poetry. Mana was one of those people who would experience ecstasy, but not happiness. Come here, I want to show you something, I said, leading her into our bedroom. When I was very young, I was obsessed with the colors of places and things my father told me about in his nightly stories. I wanted to know the color of Shahrazad's dress, her bed cover, the color of the genie and the magic lamp, and once I asked him about the color of paradise. He said it could be any color I wanted it to be. That was not enough. Then one day, when we had guests and I was eating my soup in the dining room, my eyes fell on a painting I had seen on the wall ever since I could remember, and I instantly knew the color of my paradise. And here it is, I said, proudly pointing to a small oil painting in an old wooden frame, a green landscape of lush leathery leaves with two birds, two deep red apples, a golden pear, and a touch of blue. My paradise is swimming pool blue, Mana shot in, her eyes still glued to the painting. We lived in a large garden that belonged to my grandparents, she said, turning to me. You know the old Persian gardens with their fruit trees, peaches, apples, cherries, persimmons, and a willow or two. My best memories are of swimming in our huge, irregularly shaped swimming pool. I was a swimming champion at our school, a fact my dad was very proud of. About a year after the revolution, my father died of a heart attack, and then the government confiscated our house and our garden, and we moved into an apartment. I never swam again. My dream is at the bottom of that pool. I have a recurring dream of diving in to retrieve something of my father's memory and my childhood, she said, as we walked to the living room, for the doorbell had rung again. Azin and Mitra had arrived together. Azin was taking off her black kimono-like robe. Japanese-style robes were all the rage at the time, revealing a white peasant blouse that made no pretense of covering her shoulders, big golden earrings, and pink lipstick. She had a branch of small yellow orchids, from Mitra and myself, she said in that special tone of hers that I can only describe as a flirtatious pout. Nasrin came in next. She had brought two boxes of nougats, presents from Isfahan, she declared. She was dressed in her usual uniform, navy robe, navy scarf, and black heelless shoes. When I had last seen her in class, she was wearing a huge black chador, revealing only the oval of her face and two restless hands, which, when she was not writing or doodling, were constantly in motion, as if trying to escape the confines of the thick black cloth. More recently, she had exchanged the chador for long, shapeless robes in navy, black, or dark brown, with thick matching scarves that hid her hair and framed her face. She had a small, pale face, skin so transparent you could count the veins, full eyebrows, long lashes, lively eyes, brown, a small, straight nose, and an angry mouth. An unfinished miniature by some master who had suddenly been called away from his job and left the meticulously drawn face imprisoned in a careless splash of dark color. We heard the sound of screeching tires and sudden brakes. I looked out the window. A small old Renault, cream-colored, had pulled up on the curb. Behind the wheel, a young man with fashionable sunglasses and a defiant profile rested his black-sleeved arm on the curve of the open window and gave the impression that he was driving a Porsche. He was staring straight in front of him as he talked to the woman beside him. Only once did he turn his head to his right with what I could guess was a cross expression. And that was when the woman got out of the car and he angrily slammed the door behind her. As she walked to our front door, he threw his head out and shouted a few words, but she did not turn back to answer. The old Renault was Sanaz's. She had bought it with money saved from her job. I turned towards the room, blushing for Sanaz. That must be the obnoxious brother, I thought. Seconds later, the doorbell rang, and I heard Sanaz's hurried steps and opened the door to her. She looked harassed, as if she had been running from a stalker or a thief. As soon as she saw me, she adjusted her face into a smile and said breathlessly, "I hope I'm not too late." There were two very important men dominating Sanaz's life at the time. The first was her brother. He was 19 years old and had not yet finished high school and was the darling of their parents who, after two girls, one of whom had died at the age of three, had finally been blessed with a son. He was spoiled, and his one obsession in life was Sanaz. He had taken to proving his masculinity by spying on her, listening to her phone conversations, driving her car around, and monitoring her actions. Her parents had tried to appease Sanaz and begged her, as the older sister, to be patient and understanding, to use her motherly instincts to see him through this difficult period. The other was her childhood sweetheart, a boy she had known since she was 11. Their parents were best friends, and their families spent most of their time and vacations together. Sanaz and Ali seemed to have been in love forever. Their parents encouraged this union and called it a match made in heaven. When Ali went away to England 6 years ago, his mother took to calling Sanaz his bride. They wrote to each other, sent photographs, and recently, when the number of Sanaz's suitors increased, there were talks of engagement and a reunion in Turkey where Iranians did not require entrance visas. Any day now it might happen, an event Sanaz looked forward to with some fear and trepidation. I had never seen Sanaz without her uniform and stood there almost transfixed as she took off her robe and scarf. She was wearing an orange t-shirt tucked into tight jeans and brown boots. Yet the most radical transformation was the mass of shimmering dark brown hair that now framed her face. She shook her magnificent hair from side to side, a gesture that I later noticed was a habit with her. She would toss her head and run her fingers through her hair every once in a while, as if making sure that her most prized possession was still there. Her features looked softer and more radiant. The black scarf she wore in public made her small face look emaciated and almost hard. "I'm sorry I'm a little late," she said breathlessly, running her fingers through her hair. "My brother insisted on driving me, and he refused to wake up on time. He never gets up before 10, but he wanted to know where I was going. I might be off on some secret tryst. You know, a date or something. I have been worrying in case any of you would get into trouble for this class," I said, inviting them all to take their seats around the table in the living room. "I hope your parents and spouses feel comfortable with our arrangement." Nasreen, who was wandering around the room, inspecting the paintings as if seeing them for the first time, paused to say offhandedly, "I mentioned the idea very casually to my father, just to test his reaction, and he vehemently disapproved." "How did you convince him to let you come?" I asked. "I lied," she said.
"You lied?
What else can one do with a person who is so dictatorial he won't let his daughter at this age, go to an all-female literature class? Besides, isn't this how we treat the regime? Can we tell the Revolutionary Guards the truth? We lie to them. We hide our satellite dishes. We tell them we don't have illegal books and alcohol in our houses. Even my venerable father lies to them when the safety of his family is at stake, Nasreen added defiantly. What if he calls me to check on you? I said half-teasingly. He won't. I gave a brilliant alibi. I said Mahshid and I had volunteered to help translate Islamic texts into English. And he believed you? Well, he had no reason not to. I hadn't lied to him before, not really, and it was what he wanted to believe. And he trusts Mahshid completely. So if he calls me, I should lie to him, I persisted. It's up to you, Nasreen said after a pause, looking down at her twisting hands. Do you think you should tell him? By now I could hear a note of desperation in her voice. Am I getting you into trouble? Nasreen always acted so confident that sometimes I forgot how vulnerable she really was under that tough girl act. Of course I would respect your confidence, I said more gently. As you said, you're a big girl. You know what you're doing. I had settled into my usual chair opposite the mirror where the mountains had come to stay. It is strange to look into a mirror and see not yourself, but a view so distant from you. Mahshid, after some hesitation, had taken the chair to my right. On the couch, Mana settled to the far right and Azin to the far left. They instinctively kept their distance. Sanaz and Mitra were perched on the love seat, their heads close together as they whispered and giggled. At this point, Yasi and Nasreen came in and looked around for seats. Azin patted the empty part of the couch, inviting Yasi with her hand. Yasi hesitated for a moment and then slid between Azin and Mana. She slumped into place and seemed to leave little room for her two companions, who sat upright and a little stiff in their respective corners. Without her robe, she looked a little overweight, as if she had not as yet lost her baby fat. Nasreen had gone to the dining room in search of a chair. We can squeeze you in here, said Mana. No, thank you. I actually prefer straight-backed chairs. When she returned, she placed her chair between the couch and Mahshid. They kept that arrangement faithfully to the end. It became representative of their emotional boundaries and personal relations. And so began our first class. 5. Up, Silamba! I heard Yasi exclaim as I entered the dining room with a tray of tea. Yasi loved playing with words. Once she told us that her obsession with words was pathological. As soon as I discover a new word, I have to use it, she said, like someone who buys an evening gown and is so eager that she wears it to the movies or to lunch. Let me pause and rewind the reel to retrace the events leading us to Yasi's exclamation. This was our first session. All of us had been nervous and inarticulate. We were used to meeting in public, mainly in classrooms and in lecture halls. The girls had their separate relationships with me, but except for Nasreen and Mahshid, who were intimate, and a certain friendship between Mitra and Sanaz, the rest were not close. In many cases, in fact, they would never have chosen to be friends. The collective intimacy made them uncomfortable. I had explained to them the purpose of the class: to read, discuss, and respond to works of fiction. Each would have a private diary in which she should record her responses to the novels, as well as ways in which these works and their discussions related to her personal and social experiences. I explained that I had chosen them for this class because they seemed dedicated to the study of literature. I mentioned that one of the criteria for the books I had chosen was their author's faith in the critical and almost magical power of literature, and reminded them of the 19-year-old Nabokov, who during the Russian Revolution would not allow himself to be diverted by the sound of bullets. He kept on writing his solitary poems while he heard the guns and saw the bloody fights from his window. "Let us see," I said, "whether 70 years later our disinterested faith will reward us by transforming the gloomy reality created of this other revolution." The first work we discussed was 1001 Nights, the familiar tale of the cuckolded king who slew successive virgin wives as revenge for his queen's betrayal, and whose murderous hand was finally stayed by the entrancing storyteller Shahrazad. I formulated certain general questions for them to consider, the most central of which was how these great works of imagination could help us in our present trapped situation as women. We were not looking for blueprints, for an easy solution, but we did hope to find a link between the open spaces the novels provided and the closed ones we were confined to. I remember reading to my girls Nabokov's claim that readers were born free and ought to remain free. What had most intrigued me about the frame story of 1001 Nights were the three kinds of women it portrayed, all victims of a king's unreasonable rule. Before Shahrazad enters the scene, the women in the story are divided into those who betray and then are killed, the queen, and those who are killed before they have a chance to betray, the virgins. The virgins, who, unlike Shahrazad, have no voice in the story, are mostly ignored by the critics. Their silence, however, is significant. They surrender their virginity and their lives without resistance or protest. They do not quite exist because they leave no trace in their anonymous death. The queen's infidelity does not rob the king of his absolute authority. It throws him off balance. Both types of women, the queen and the virgins, tacitly accept the king's public authority by acting within the confines of his domain and by accepting its arbitrary laws. Shahrazad breaks the cycle of violence by choosing to embrace different terms of engagement. She fashions her universe not through physical force, as does the king, but through imagination and reflection. This gives her the courage to risk her life and sets her apart from the other characters in the tale. Our edition of 1001 Nights came in 6 volumes. I, luckily, had bought mine before it was banned and sold only on the black market for exorbitant prices. I divided the volumes among the girls and asked them for the next session to classify the tales according to the types of women who played central roles in the stories. Once I had given them their assignment, I asked them each to tell the rest of us why they had chosen to spend their Thursday mornings here discussing Nabokov and Jane Austen. Their answers were brief and forced. In order to break the ice, I suggested the calming distraction of cream puffs and tea. This brings us to the moment when I enter the dining room with 8 glasses of tea on an old and unpolished silver tray. Brewing and serving tea is an aesthetic ritual in Iran, performed several times a day. We serve tea in transparent glasses, small and shapely, the most popular of which is called slim-waisted, round and full at the top, narrow in the middle, and round and full at the bottom. The color of the tea and its subtle aroma are an indication of the brewer's skill. I step into the dining room with 8 slim-waisted glasses whose honey-colored liquid trembles seductively. At this point, I hear Yossi shout triumphantly, "Absilamba!" She throws the word at me like a ball, and I take a mental leap to catch it. Apsilamba. The word carries me back to the spring of 1994, when four of my girls and Nima were auditing a class I was teaching on the 20th century novel. The class's favorite book was Nabokov's Invitation to a Beheading. In this novel, Nabokov differentiates Cincinnatus C., his imaginative and lonely hero, from those around him through his originality in a society where uniformity is not only the norm, but also the law. Even as a child, Nabokov tells us, Cincinnatus appreciated the freshness and beauty of language, while other children, he wrote, understood each other at the first word, since they had no words that would end in an unexpected way, perhaps in some archaic letter, an apsilamba, becoming a bird or catapult with wondrous consequences. No one in class had bothered to ask what the word meant. No one, that is, who was properly taking the class, for many of my old students just stayed on and sat in on my classes long after their graduation. Often, they were more interested and worked harder than my regular students who were taking the class for credit. Thus it was that those who audited the class, including Nasreen, Mana, Nima, Mahshid, and Yasi, had one day gathered in my office to discuss this and a number of other questions. I decided to play a little game with the class to test their curiosity. On the midterm exam, one of the questions was, explain the significance of the word apsilamba in the context of invitation to a beheading. What does the word mean, and how does it relate to the main theme of the novel? Except for four or five students, no one had any idea what I could possibly mean, a point I did not forget to remind them of every once in a while throughout the rest of that term. The truth was that apsilamba was one of Nabokov's fanciful creations, possibly a word he invented out of epsilon, the 20th letter in the Greek alphabet, and lambda, the 11th. So that first day in our private class, we let our minds play again and invented new meanings of our own. I said I associated apsilamba with the impossible joy of a suspended leap. Yossi, who seemed excited for no particular reason, cried out that she always thought it could be the name of a dance. You know, come on, baby, do the apsilamba with me. I proposed that for the next time, they each write a sentence or two explaining what the word meant to them. Mana suggested that apsilamba evoked the image of small silver fish leaping in and out of a moonlit lake. Nima added in parentheses, just so you won't forget me, although you have barred me from your class, an apsilamba to you too. For Azin, it was a sound, a melody. Mahshid described an image of three girls jumping rope and shouting apsilamba with each leap. For Sanaz, the word was a small African boy's secret magical name. Mitra wasn't sure why the word reminded her of the paradox of a blissful sigh. And to Nasreen, it was the magic code that opened the door to a secret cave filled with treasures. Apsilamba became part of our increasing repository of coded words and expressions, a repository that grew over time until gradually we had created a secret language of our own. That word became a symbol, a sign of that vague sense of joy, the tingle in the spine Nabokov expected his readers to feel in the act of reading fiction. It was a sensation that separated the good readers, as he called them, from the ordinary ones. It also became the code word that opened the secret cave of remembrance. 6. In his foreword to the English edition of Invitation to a Beheading, 1959, Nabokov reminds the reader that his novel does not offer tout pour tout, nothing of the kind. It is, he claims, a violin in the void. And yet he goes on to say, I know a few readers who will jump up, ruffling their hair. Well, absolutely. The original version, Nabokov tells us, was published in installments in 1935, almost six decades later, in a world unknown and presumably unknowable to Nabokov, in a forlorn living room with windows looking out towards distant white-capped mountains. Time and again, I would stand witness to the unlikeliest of readers as they lost themselves in a madness of hair ruffling. Invitation to a Beheading begins with the announcement that its fragile hero, Cincinnatus C., has been sentenced to death for the crime of Gnostic turpitude. In a place where all citizens are required to be transparent, he's opaque. The principal characteristic of this world is its arbitrariness. The condemned man's only privilege is to know the time of his death. But the executioners keep even this from him, turning every day into a day of execution. As the story unfolds, the reader discovers with increasing discomfort the artificial texture of this strange place. The moon from the window is fake. So is the spider in the corner, which according to convention must become the prisoner's faithful companion. The director of the jail, the jailer, and the defense lawyer are all the same man and keep changing places. The most important character, the executioner, is first introduced to the prisoner under another name and as a fellow prisoner, Monsieur Pierre. The executioner and the condemned man must learn to love each other and cooperate in the act of execution, which will be celebrated in a gaudy feast. In this staged world, Cincinnatus's only window to another universe is his writing. The world of the novel is one of empty rituals. Every act is bereft of substance and significance, and even death becomes a spectacle for which the good citizens buy tickets. It is only through these empty rituals that brutality becomes possible. In another Nabokov novel, The Real Life of Sebastian Knight, Sebastian's brother discovers two seemingly incongruous pictures in his dead brother's library: a pretty curly-haired child playing with a dog and a Chinese man in the act of being beheaded. The two pictures remind us of the close relation between banality and brutality. Nabokov had a special Russian term for this, poshlost. Poshlost, Nabokov explains, is not only the obviously trashy, but mainly the falsely important, the falsely beautiful, the falsely clever, the falsely attractive. Yes, there are many examples you can bring from everyday life, from the politician's sugary speeches to certain writer's proclamations to chickens. Chickens? You know, the ones street vendors sell nowadays. If you lived in Tehran, you couldn't possibly miss them. The ones they dip in paint, shocking pink, brilliant red, or turquoise blue, in order to make them more attractive. Or the plastic flowers, the bright pink and blue artificial gladiolas carted out at the university, both for mourning and for celebration. What Nabokov creates for us in Invitation to a Beheading is not the actual physical pain and torture of a totalitarian regime, but the nightmarish quality of living in an atmosphere of perpetual dread. Cincinnatus is frail. He's passive. He's a hero without knowing or acknowledging it. He fights with his instincts, and his acts of writing are his means of escape. He's a hero because he refuses to become like all the rest. Unlike in other utopian novels, the forces of evil here are not omnipotent. Nabokov shows us their frailty as well. They are ridiculous and they can be defeated, and this does not lessen the tragedy, the waste. Invitation to a Beheading is written from the point of view of the victim, one who ultimately sees the absurd sham of his persecutors and who must retreat into himself in order to survive. Those of us living in the Islamic Republic of Iran grasped both the tragedy and the absurdity of the cruelty to which we were subjected. We had to poke fun at our own misery in order to survive. We also instinctively recognized poshlost, not just in others, but in ourselves. This was one reason that art and literature became so essential to our lives. They were not a luxury, but a necessity. What Nabokov captured was the texture of life in a totalitarian society where you are completely alone in an illusory world full of false promises, where you can no longer differentiate between your savior and your executioner. We formed a special bond with Nabokov, despite the difficulty of his prose. This went deeper than our identification with his themes. His novels are shaped around invisible trapdoors, sudden gaps that constantly pull the carpet from under the reader's feet. They are filled with mistrust of what we call everyday reality, an acute sense of that reality's fickleness and frailty. There was something both in his fiction and in his life that we instinctively related to and grasped: the possibility of a boundless freedom when all options are taken away. I think that was what drove me to create the class. My main link with the outside world had been the university. And now that I had severed that link, there on the brink of the void, I could invent the violin or be devoured by the void. 7. The two photographs should be placed side by side. Both embody the fragile unreality, to quote Nabokov on his own state of exile, of our existence in the Islamic Republic of Iran. One cancels the other, and yet without one, the other is incomplete. In the first photograph, standing there in our black robes and scarves, we are as we had been shaped by someone else's dreams. In the second, we appear as we imagined ourselves. In neither could we feel completely at home. The second photograph belonged to the world inside the living room. But outside, underneath the window that deceptively showcased only the mountains and the tree outside our house, was the other world, where the bad witches and furies were waiting to transform us into the hooded creatures of the first. The best way I can think of explaining this self-negating and paradoxical inferno is through an anecdote, one that, like similar anecdotes, defies fiction to become its own metaphor. The chief film censor in Iran, up until 1994, was blind. Well, nearly blind. Before that, he was a censor for theater. One of my playwright friends once described how he would sit in the theater wearing thick glasses that seemed to hide more than they revealed. An assistant who sat by him would explain the action on stage, and he would dictate the parts that needed to be cut. After 1994, this censor became the head of the new television channel. There he perfected his methods and demanded that the scriptwriters give him their scripts on audio tape. They were forbidden to make them attractive or dramatize them in any way. He then made his judgments about the scripts based on the tapes. More interesting, however, is the fact that his successor, who was not blind, not physically that is, nonetheless followed the same system. Our world, under the mullah's rule, was shaped by the colorless lenses of the blind censor. Not just our reality, but also our fiction had taken on this curious coloration in a world where the censor was the poet's rival in rearranging and reshaping reality, where we simultaneously invented ourselves and were figments of someone else's imagination. We lived in a culture that denied any merit to literary works, considering them important only when they were handmaidens to something seemingly more urgent, namely ideology. This was a country where all gestures, even the most private, were interpreted in political terms. The colors of my headscarf or my father's tie were symbols of Western decadence and imperialist tendencies. Not wearing a beard, shaking hands with members of the opposite sex, clapping or whistling in public meetings were likewise considered Western and therefore decadent, part of the plot by imperialists to bring down our culture. A few years ago, some members of the Iranian parliament set up an investigative committee to examine the content of national television. The committee issued a lengthy report in which it condemned the showing of Billy Budd because it claimed the story promoted homosexuality. Ironically, the Iranian television programmers had mainly chosen that film because of its lack of female characters. The cartoon version of Around the World in 80 Days was also castigated because the main character, a lion, was British, and the film ended in that bastion of imperialism, London. Our class was shaped within this context in an attempt to escape the gaze of the blind censor for a few hours each week. There in that living room, we rediscovered that we were also living, breathing human beings, and no matter how repressive the state became, no matter how intimidated and frightened we were, like Lolita, we tried to escape and to create our own little pockets of freedom. And like Lolita, we took every opportunity to flaunt our insubordination by showing a little hair from under our scarves, insinuating a little color into the drab uniformity of our appearances, growing our nails, falling in love, and listening to forbidden music. An absurd fictionality ruled our lives. We tried to live in the open spaces, in the chinks created between that room which had become our protective cocoon, and the censor's world of witches and goblins outside. Which of these two worlds was more real? And to which did we really belong? We no longer knew the answers. Perhaps one way of finding out the truth was to do what we did, to try to imaginatively articulate those two worlds and through that process give shape to our vision and identity. 8. How can I create this other world outside the room? I have no choice but to appeal once again to your imagination. Let's imagine one of the girls, say Sanaz, leaving my house, and let us follow her from there to her final destination. She says her goodbyes and puts on her black robe and scarf over her orange shirt and jeans, coiling her scarf around her neck to cover her huge gold earrings. She directs wayward strands of hair under the scarf, puts her notes into her large bag, straps it on over her shoulder, and walks out into the hall. She pauses a moment on top of the stairs to put on thin, lacy black gloves to hide her nail polish. We follow Sanaz down the stairs, out the door, and into the street. You might notice that her gait and her gestures have changed. It is in her best interest not to be seen, not to be heard or noticed. She doesn't walk upright, but bends her head towards the ground and doesn't look at passers-by. She walks quickly and with a sense of determination. The streets of Tehran and other Iranian cities are patrolled by militia who ride in white Toyota patrols, four gun-carrying men and women, sometimes followed by a minibus. They are called the Blood of God. They patrol the streets to make sure that women like Sanaz wear their veils properly, do not wear makeup, do not walk in public with men who are not their fathers, brothers, or husbands. She will pass slogans on the walls, quotations from Khomeini, and a group called the Party of God. The slogans read, "Men who wear ties are U.S. lackeys. Veiling is a woman's protection." Beside the slogan is a charcoal drawing of a woman. Her face is featureless and framed by a dark chador. The slogan reads, "My sister, guard your veil. My brother, guard your eyes." If she gets on a bus, the seating is segregated. She must enter through the rear door and sit in the back seats allocated to women. Yet in taxis, which accept as many as 5 passengers, men and women are squeezed together like sardines, as the saying goes. And the same goes with minibuses, where so many of my students complain of being harassed by bearded and God-fearing men. You might well ask, what is Sana's thinking as she walks the streets of Tehran? How much does this experience affect her? Most probably she tries to distance her mind as much as possible from her surroundings. Perhaps she's thinking of her brother or of her distant boyfriend and the time when she will meet him in Turkey. Does she compare her own situation with her mother's when she was the same age? Is she angry that women of her mother's generation could walk the streets freely, enjoy the company of the opposite sex, join the police force, become pilots, live under laws that were amongst the most progressive in the world regarding women? Does she feel humiliated by the new laws, by the fact that after the revolution, the age of marriage was lowered from 18 to 9, that stoning became once more the punishment for adultery and prostitution?